And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today, and we're going to get right into it. And I know many of our listeners are into mushrooms or fungi, and we have not really interviewed a mushroom grower on the show before. So I thought it was time to interview a mushroom grower, and Andrew Priest, who is with MediCere, which is a urban farm that specializes in growing mushrooms and also connecting people with wild mushrooms as well, especially for the restaurant industry, but also at places like the St. Anne de Bellevue Farmers Market. And that's where I met up with Andrew Priest. And so today on our show, we're going to have an interview with Andrew Priest coming up. And after that, we are going to go back into the Ecolibrium archives and pull out an interview I did some years ago with a biologist named Sharif Darwish, who is a mycophile. And a mycophile is a passionate lover of fungi. So the show today is all about mushrooms. So stay tuned. It's going to be good. So here now is my interview with Andrew Priest from the MediCere Urban Farm. And this is Ryan Young for CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with Andrew Priest. Andrew Priest is with MediCere, and they sell mushrooms at the St. Anne de Bellevue Market, the Marché St. Anne, which happens every Saturday at the St. George's Church in the wintertime between 10 and 1. So we've never really interviewed a mushroom grower on our show before, and a lot of people are interested in mushrooms for their health benefits and other things. So how are you doing today, Andrew?
Doing well. We're just finishing up the market here, starting to warm up. And so, yeah, people are coming out, and we're looking forward to moving back outside where there's going to be even more people that we can serve great mushrooms to.
And so what interested you about growing mushrooms at first?
So originally I was just online and just going through some YouTube videos, and I had come across a gentleman in British Columbia who was basically growing mushrooms out of like a temple. So he was in the Okanagan Valley, and he was able to grow mushrooms that as a chef I had never seen previously in Montreal. You know, for the 10 plus years that I've been cooking in Montreal, I hadn't seen any of these varieties. And it seemed like the setup was so bare bones that it almost like it was appealing, because it looked like the barrier to entry was quite low. So that kind of got me interested. Furthermore, I listened to a podcast, the Joe Rogan podcast with Paul Stamets, who is a mycologist on the West Coast. He might be, probably the most famous a mycologist / mushroom associated person in the world. And he was talking about the benefits of lion's mane mushrooms and medicinal mushrooms and the research that they were doing. Also for psychedelic mushrooms being used for different clinical research for PTSD or depression. And at the time I was selling some as a side hustle. I was selling some stuff on Amazon, and I thought that I could maybe do some lion's mane mushroom capsules. And so that's what sprouted the name MediCere. We were going to be a medical greenhouse that was going to be focused on high-end, very good quality mushrooms with potential medicinal benefits that we were going to commercialize. We never really got there. The demand for the restaurants, the culinary scene in the city has pretty much taken over the demand for the business. And so we never really got to the point of producing medicinal mushroom tablets, but something that we keep in mind for sure as research continues and as we continue to grow mushrooms and further, our craft.
And so you were a chef at first?
Yeah, so I had graduated culinary school in 2010, been working in various restaurants in the city since. Never saw a lot of these mushrooms that I saw on this in the Okanagan Valley on this YouTube channel. And I thought to myself, well, there's obviously a gap in the market for this product. As a chef, it's not available. It should be made available, because chefs love to play with interesting ingredients. And to the extent that ingredients are available year-round in this climate, and locally produced, chefs prefer that. So when I saw these foliotas, which are more commonly known as speckled chestnuts or cinnamon caps, as we like to call them. I just said that, you know, if this is worth a, it's worth a try for sure. Like I had never seen them in a commercial setting before. So I knew they weren't on the market. And I said, someone's got to bring this to the market. There's no way that Montreal, with all the culinary prowess that we have as a city, you know, should, there's no way that we should not have these mushrooms available. And, you know, if someone can produce them locally and I can do that, then, I think it's a great addition to the city, and it just it's an awesome little thing to have too. You know, urban agriculture is very 21st century, and the chefs appreciate it. People at the farmers market love that we're doing urban agriculture, employing locals that are passionate about agriculture. We have actually a student who's starting with us from McGill, first year agricultural student at McGill, who's going to be starting with us in May, most probably. So we're, you know, instead of having foreign workers coming into the city and working on farms, to the extent that we can encourage locals who want to work in agriculture, if we can give them an opportunity to work in the domain that they've chosen, all the better. So chefs love it, the people at the farmers market love it, and I would say, as the students as well. People who are passionate about agriculture, who want to work in a mushroom farm, maybe want to get a little bit away from desk jobs as well. Like, it's a great opportunity for those kind of people to find something a little bit more that they might be a little bit more passionate about.
And kind of in a simplified way, what do you need to grow mushrooms?
Okay, so the mushrooms, so we have, there's kind of like three main varieties of mushrooms. You have mushrooms that will eat compost and like kind of manure. That's your button mushroom, cremini, portobello, Agaricus bisporus. So that's the family of mushrooms that you would normally find in the grocery store. Then you have wild mushrooms, which wild mushrooms usually, I would say, are wood-loving species. So the mycelium that grows the mushroom is mycelium that digests hydrocarbons in the wood. The thing about wild mushrooms is that they also need a sugar / mineral exchange with the root systems of certain varieties of trees to work. So chanterelles, morels, porcini. The porcini is the fruit body. The mushroom is the fruit body itself. And the tree is the mycelium, if that makes sense. So the tree / mycelium, which is the root structure, which is really the more living part of the mushroom, is connected in a way through the ground to the root system of certain trees. And there's a sugar and mineral exchange. The mycelium often needs sugars from the trees to grow, and the trees demand minerals from the mycelium. So there's a symbiotic relationship that's occurring underground, and which causes these mushrooms to be able to propagate in nature. And then there's a third variety that's quite similar to the second variety. However, it does not require this symbiotic relationship. So we are using wood chips and soybean hulls as a supplement to grow our mushrooms on. So these are wood-loving mushrooms. So they love hydrocarbons, like the second variety, which is wild. However, they don't require this symbiotic relationship with certain varieties of trees in order to be able to properly grow and propagate in any setting. So we're able to control the setting indoors, and we're able to grow. We can grow probably like 15 varieties successfully with our system. Just by feeding what we call master's mix, which is usually 50% hardwood sawdust and 50% soybean hulls. The reason for the soybean hulls is because soybean hulls have a little bit more protein, and the protein, when it's unbound, is like nitrogen. So the nitrogen, just like in regular farming, is something that's essential for healthy plant growth. It's also essential for healthy mushroom yield, which makes us, competitively are able to commercialize the product.
And so you're based in Laval, is that right?
Yeah, so we have an outdoor field in Laval, but the mushroom operation is actually in Longueuil. So we commandeered a basement that I had access to, 1,800 square feet. And so, the basement wasn't really, basically what had happened was, it's a building that I take care of. for my grandfather who owns it, and we were never really able to commercialize the basement. And so for years it's been on my mind, like, what to do with the space. It's almost 2,000 square feet, so it's quite sizable. And yeah, finally when I said, okay, mushroom farm, like, I have the space, let me give this a try. So we kind of strung a budget together and yeah, got to it. Took about 3 months to build out the farm. Through YouTube again, I was able to find someone in Ontario, Top Shelf Mushroom in Meaford, Ontario, Brad Coons. He was able to help me design the mushroom farm, as he was already a mushroom farmer for 13 years, I believe, when I had started. So he was our consultant on the project. He basically told me, you know, how much airflow I needed in the room, what kind of humidity, what kind of humidifiers I needed to buy, what kind of humidity levels I needed to achieve, temperatures, how to attain those temperatures, all that kind of stuff. So with a little bit of mentorship from Brad, we were able to throw this project together within 3 months. And yeah, we were fruiting mushrooms. We had started basically building in January of 2019, and then we were fruiting mushrooms in I think first or second week of April.
And do they have to be in the dark, and is that why a basement is good?
So a basement is good because you have less fluctuation in temperature. You know, other reasons why basements are good is because, yes, they're known to have a little bit of higher humidity, but we're not really pulling any humidity out of the basement. And then the darkness aspect. So this is a question I get asked quite often, because people have seen Champignon de Paris farms, which is the white button mushroom farm, often. So the white button mushroom, I'm not an expert on it, but to my knowledge, the difference between a white button mushroom and a cremini is the amount of light that the mushroom receives. So basically, if you grow Agaricus bisporus in the dark, it stays white. And if you grow Agaricus bisporus in some kind of illuminated area, then the mushroom starts to tint and become more brown, and that's what gives you a cremini. So for our purposes, there's not many varieties of mushroom that we grow that need light. Certainly not to any extent that, like, the mushroom wouldn't be edible or wouldn't be as good if we didn't have the proper amount of light. But I will say that the blue oyster that we grow definitely needs a little bit of light for it to become blue. It won't pigment, it seems, if it grows in the dark. And the reason I know that is because at one point, when we were starting to grow mushrooms, we were getting blocks of inoculated mycelium substrate in from Brad. And so at one point, one of the blocks had started fruiting, and this block, it was inside a cardboard container. And inside the cardboard container, the mushrooms had grown, but they grew white, and they were blue oysters, but they grew, like, almost pure white. And it's because they didn't have access to enough light that they stayed white, I think.
And in terms of how COVID has affected your business, good or bad, you know, I mean, because you were selling to restaurants. Restaurants have been forced to close sometimes. How has that been?
Yeah, so, I mean, candidly, it's a little bit disastrous, you know. Suppliers in the city for restaurants were affected in, you know, big ways, to put it, you know, lightly. So you could imagine a business running on, you know, full steam, serving 30, 40, 50 restaurants in a given week, you know, setting up its pipeline, its manufacturing pipeline, or even its supply inventory. Let's say it's a reseller, $20, $30, $40, $50, $100,000 worth of stock that it's ready to sell every week, that they know they have a consistent demand for. All of a sudden, the demand goes to zero or near zero. So yeah, it's challenging would be a mild way of putting it.
And so the farmer's market, like this farmer's market, has been important then for you, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So luckily, the first shutdown happened early enough in 2020, I guess it was, that we were able to sign up for a bunch of farmers markets for that year. The farmers markets are key for, you know, just to be able to, you know, liquidate product that you would no longer be able to liquidate because restaurants are closed. So even though the volumes are less, it really helps with loss mitigation, farmers markets do. And yeah, I would say if we didn't have farmers markets, if we didn't have butcher shops and some grocery stores, you know, at some points sales would have gone to near zero.
And do you find that there is like a renewed interest in mushrooms that is even like, I think people, there's always been a lot of people who are into mushrooms, but there seems to be an even more craze for them now. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would say there's something about mushrooms right now that's happening. You know, you can call it trending or whatever. There's renewed interest in a few aspects that are bringing a lot of attention to mushroom, mainly the medicinal use of psilocybin as a Schedule I drug. It wasn't available for clinical trial for any medicinal use, any clinical therapeutic use in the United States since, I guess, 1960, which now it seems like that's kind of turning. People are starting at you know, really well-renowned universities in the U.S. primarily, and I think also in British Columbia a little bit, are starting to do clinical experiments with psilocybin. So that's an avenue by which a lot of interest is being being gathered for mushrooms. The medicinal properties as well, you know, the lion's mane, there was at one point in 1991, there was a clinical trial done on mice, and they had found that lion's mane mushroom was able to regenerate the myelin sheath, which is a sheathing that protects the nerve endings in the brain. Which basically, they say that sheathing degrading is what causes Alzheimer's and dementia. So that brought a lot of attention to, you know, the medicinal aspects of mushrooms. And then we also have this Eastern practice of shaga, reishi, cordyceps being used for many years. And, you know, the exploration into more natural remedies and the exploration into... natural remedies, I guess, is what I would say. That's right now gaining a lot of steam, and that's bringing a lot of attention towards mushrooms too. So, there's the culinary aspect with the new varieties that we're able to commercialize. There's this medicinal aspect for you know, these wild varieties, and this possibly medicinal aspect as well for the psilocybin, which is the magic mushroom. So there's a bunch of different reasons why mushrooms are starting to become more popular, for sure.
And Paul Stamets is probably part of that too.
Yeah, Paul Stamets. I mean, he is the probably, you know, the godfather of West Coast mushrooms. That's for sure. And he's all over those studies. At one point, I know that he did a study. He was incorporated with a study where they were trying to stack a few different kind of drugs together to treat people with Alzheimer's possibly. So they wanted to use, I think, niacin, which I think is vitamin B, which creates like a flush in the body. So the theory was that this vitamin B was going to help to bring these molecules deep towards the nerve blood vessel endings and possibly the nerve endings in the brain. And that vitamin B was supposed to help carry lion's mane and a little bit psilocybin as well. So there was some studies that they're very interesting studies that really encompass a lot of the this 21st century mushroom potential.
And being a chef, why do you think chefs like mushrooms, and why is it a culinary thing? Did you have a perspective on that as a chef?
Yeah, well, there's a few things I would say. I mean, mushrooms are very tasty, very versatile. You know, it's a great protein substitute in a dish. So that's a no-brainer for any chef who's looking for something, you know, which the struggle is to find good food that is, let's say, vegan or vegetarian or some kind of substitute that's not trying to be pretentious, but is just good. So for that, mushrooms fit the bill very well. Other than that, like as a side or in a sauce or whatever, like you can use mushrooms in so many different ways. They can, you know, you can really dress up a risotto or a pasta dish with a mushroom. And then I think furthermore, you have the wild mushroom aspect, which is like, you know, to an extent, the chefs are competing with each other on the market, and accessibility to scarce product is something that I think sets you apart. And so if you can get your hands on really, really fresh, wild mushrooms when almost no one else has them, it sets you apart. It's like a demarcating kind of item on the menu. So I think that chefs love to have those kind of things, and they're so focused on quality and freshness and how it's going to present on the plate. Like, wild mushroom is a great addition to a lot of restaurant dishes to help fulfill that.
And so do you do wild foraging yourself?
Yeah, so we don't really have that much time to do foraging. And I would be honest, like, Quebec is not the most consistent environment to get wild mushrooms. But we will try to buy from local people, you know, local pickers as much as we can. But we have a network that right now is extending from Halifax to British Columbia to Vancouver. And we, you know, depending on the season and the varietals that are available, we call different pickers up and we buy from different pickers. And that's the only real way to get the volume and the volume of mushrooms that we need for the amount of chefs that we serve and the, like, to extend the seasons of those specific varieties. We got to move to where the mushrooms are growing next. For instance, on the East Coast, they actually pop, like, the chanterelle will actually pop on the East Coast before it pops on the West Coast. And that could be a huge advantage. Like, last year, we didn't get much chanterelle from BC, and from BC, Oregon area. We didn't get any from Saskatchewan, which is surprising. Usually from Saskatchewan, we always get. But yeah, Nova Scotia was the first place to have chanterelle last year. So we were getting for 2 or 3 weeks from Nova Scotia, and then we started moving more east. And then finally, we end up in the west where we can still get mushrooms right now. And it's the first week of March. We can still get mushrooms from Oregon and California right now. Early in the year, it mostly comes from BC, but we can get mushrooms up in Yukon as well.
And how did you find your way to the St. Anne's Market? Was that through Ramsey Kassouf and Jardin Carrier?
Yeah, it was. We actually had a client, how I met Ramsey was because we actually had a client in common who put me in contact with Ramsey. And then I think the first time I called him, we spoke on the phone for maybe 3 hours. So relationships got off to a pretty good start. And we had a lot of ideals that kind of aligned. And yeah, we still talk often. Like, I consider him a mentor of mine as well. And yeah, he introduced me to the farmers market here in St. Anne. And ever since, yeah, it's been great to us. The people, the reception here is awesome. The experience of being here as well in the winter, even, you know, we're still able to make this feasible in the winter, which you know, there's almost no other farmers markets in the winter. So it's awesome that. That we're here. It's awesome that we found Ramsey and that we were able to find this spot. And the reception here has been awesome.
And so you have your regular customers and they always come for the same things, or and sometimes you introduce them to new stuff.
Yeah, totally. I think one of the best things is the fact that we rotate through different varieties throughout the year. And even customers who are like, you know, hooked on the shiitake or hooked on the maitake, you know, even if they might be disappointed a little bit if the maitake is not in, for instance, which happens kind of often, or the lion's mane in particular is not in that week. But they're always happy to try something new, right? So we had some black trumpets in last week, and today I spoke to a few people who had the black trumpets. I couldn't believe how good they were. Same for the yellowfoot chanterelles. So, you know, experiencing new things is always going to be a winning proposition. And especially in the COVID era, where it's a lot of repetition and not so much novelty happening in people's lives, that, you know, the mushroom stand was actually a little bit of a, how would you put it? A little bit of a, like a bright spot on someone's day, you know, throughout COVID. So that was kind of awesome to be able to just give, you know, people, you know, a little novelty in their lives during a tough time.
And so you sell at the St. Anne's Farmers Market. Where else can people get your product?
So we have a lot of butcher shops in the city. You know, mainly I would say Bushdie Grinder, Pure Horticulture is our grocery store that probably does the most volume of cultivated mushrooms in the city. Pure Horticulture, Bushdie Grinder, Fruiteries Plateau on Roy, Fruiteries Plateau on Laurier, AGA Butcher Shop in St. Leonard. I'm sure there's more that I can think of, but we're going to be doing farmers markets all over the city this summer. For instance, Laurier Farmers Market, which is the farmers market at Laurier Metro Station, Thursday evening, Sunday afternoon as well, same place. On Tuesday evening, we have a farmers market right in front of the culinary school that I attended on Sherbrooke and Saint-Denis. It's called Carré Saint-Louis. That's the Tuesday evening. So we're going to be a little bit all over the system. If people want to follow us on Instagram and ask where we're going to be, or, you know, mostly we'll just post where we're going to be, our schedule for farmers markets. They can follow us at Medisire MTL. And so throughout the year, we'll be able to put up the schedule for farmers markets. And if anyone wants to know where they can find product, we can always just write to them, no problem.
So that's your Instagram?
Yeah, that's our Instagram. It's the best place to contact us, really. And we have a Facebook page, but we're not as active.
So it's at Medisire MTL.
That's right.
Cool. I guess my last question would be, I guess you've already kind of covered what your future is looking like, but any other kind of projects you're hoping to develop or that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, the entrepreneur inside of me sees there's a huge opportunity in distribution for high-end products in the city. Mushroom farming is hard.
I thought it was easy, but no way.
it's challenging. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. It's a very kind of like a manufacturing process with a lot of steps, and every step, if it's not perfect, then you're opening the margin for error up ever so, always more and more. And this is the hard part about mushroom growing. And so, we need to grow the mushrooms because we need to have them to sell. The chefs want to have them. The farmers, the customers at the farmers market want to have them. But I see there's a lot of opportunity in distribution, a lot of demand for a good supplier in the city that has access to good products and has good service for the chef. So my business mind is telling me to focus more on distributing good products that I can find, let's say from Ramsey's Farm or from whatever farmers that I met here at the farmers market, to the chefs. There is a huge gap in the market for farmers who have great products. They don't necessarily have access to sell the products in the city. So I would love to help other farmers out, just facilitating that transaction, facilitating their monetization of their hard work and good product. So I think that my brain kind of tells me to go in that direction. You have this farm that you built from scratch, and you're watching it grow, and we have employees now, and we're building this whole team of production people, great people that are working at the farm, and my heart is there as well. So we're gonna try to do a combination of both, not to spread ourselves out too thin, but so something of that nature. Keep on just continuing to cultivate mushrooms and distributing our products and other great products that we can find in the city and abroad.
All right. Well, thanks for speaking to me today.
My pleasure.
And that was my interview with Andrew Priest from Medisire, which is an urban farm based out of Laval, but also growing mushrooms at a facility in Longueuil. This is a farm that specializes in growing mushrooms and also connecting customers with wild foraged mushrooms as well. And I think he also has a number of other products other than mushrooms. You can find out more by going to Medisire's Instagram, which is Medisire MTL. And Medisire is Medisere. So that was a look at mushroom growing from somebody who's actively involved in mushroom growing in the Montreal area. And now we're going to go to our archives to pull out an interview that we did some years ago with Sharif Darwish, who is a biologist and who teaches biology at John Abbott College. And Sharif Darwish has a master's of science where he looked at changes in gene expression in plants as a defense against caterpillar herbivores. But one of his real passions is mushrooms, and he is a self-proclaimed insufferable mycophile. So let's feature that now here on Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Hi, this is Brian Young here with Sharif Darwish, who is a plant biologist, and we're going to talk a little bit today about what Sharif knows about plant interactions with fungi.
Right. So a lot of people don't really realize that there is these really interesting connections that plants have with fungi. Can you give me an example?
Definitely. Might help to start off just talking about the long history of the relationship between plants and fungi, kind of in total. You can't talk about either group without talking about the other, simply because they both emerged onto terrestrial Earth around the same time. And it seems, all the evidence seems to suggest that neither of them would have survived very well without the other. So they've been kind of in cahoots for over 400 million years. And we're talking about the beginning of the greening of terrestrial Earth. This would not have been possible without the cooperation of the fungi. Both these groups kind of emerging from the seas, from an aquatic habitat, to try to adapt to the challenges of living on land, being, you know, the support, gravity. This led to, you know, adaptations of wood and cellulose, things like that, that allows plants to stand upright, and the challenges of drying out being a big one. And just the low fertility of, which was the absence of soils at the time. So seaweeds giving rise to the plants, and then aquatic fungi moving on to more soil-like habitat. So you can picture the plants coming on to the land, being really good at photosynthesis, so they can take the abundant CO2 in that primitive atmosphere, relatively primitive, again, talking over 400 million years ago. So they could make sugars really great, organic compounds fantastic, but they had really weak root systems that were totally inadequate to acquire nutrients like phosphorus, nitrogen, these kind of things that were kind of embedded in the mineral soils that were they weren't yet formed into soils, but that substrate that they were trying to colonize. And the fungi had the exact opposite kind of problems, or the exact opposite kind of issues. They were really good at getting things like water, phosphorus and nitrogen, because they grow in a very filamentous kind of form. You know, if you look at a patch of mold, it looks kind of cottony, and that cottony appearance comes from this hair-like growth pattern. And that gives them this really large surface to volume ratio that makes them just fantastic absorbers. So they were really great at absorbing the trace amounts of these essential nutrients, but they can't photosynthesize. No fungus has ever learned how to photosynthesize on its own. So they needed organic material. They needed sugars. They needed amino acids, things like that, that plants were producing through photosynthesis. So we think that they kind of co-evolved together, cooperating. The first plants being on here would have attracted the fungi to their roots and to their dying parts, being rich in organic material. So the fungi would have been growing towards any area where these primitive plants would be growing. And this led to three kind of different relationships that we still have well represented today. So we can picture a situation where the fungus grows towards the plant and waits till it dies and digests or decomposes the dead plant material. And that tends to be how far people go with their understanding of fungi. They're decomposers. That's what they do. They break down dead organic material, and then they make mushrooms out of that stuff. That's the general, you know, knowledge out there from my experience. But there are two other associations that happen. One being parasitism. You know, if you're a fungus, why wait for the plant to die? If we can learn how to just eat the plant while it's still living, great. Good for us. And we still find that, you know, the majority of all plant losses in our agriculture come from fungal diseases, not from bacteria or viruses or even insects. You know, we have a lot of our plant losses in terms of disease, I should say. Insects actually do consume more of the biomass, but in terms of disease and pathology, it's the fungi that rule. And this goes back to their intimate, you know, emergence with plants. But the third and the most, I find the most kind of inspiring or interesting, is this idea of cooperation. So some of the fungi learned how to kind of grow into the roots of these plants, forming this physical interface with the plant cells. The fungi going and exploring these primitive soils, gathering up the resources the plant needs, and then at this interface, this fungal plant interface, swapping those mineral nutrients for sugars. And this is called mycorrhizae, or mycorrhizal association. Myco meaning fungus and rhiza meaning root. So fungus root. This fungus root evolved. So this part plant, part fungus structure, that's all about this trade-off of mineral nutrients for organic nutrients. And this was so successful that now 90% of all plant species on Earth have this association. And we think most of these actually require these symbiotic associations for their healthy survival and competitive survival in these habitats. So, you know, any kind of nutrient limited ecosystem is going to be dominated by plants with these associations in their roots to this day. So this has been going on for hundreds of millions of years, this kind of trade-off, and has become very specialized to the point where we have plant roots actually changing their morphology to accommodate the fungus, and vice versa.
If I had like a gram of soil in my hand that I picked up from the forest floor, inside that gram of soil, what could there be?
You're looking at between 1 and 4 kilometers of fungal threads, you know, and a lot of that, if it's forest floor, like in the Arboretum here in St. Anne, you know, 1 gram or 1 cubic centimeter of that soil, you're looking at between 1 and 4 kilometers of these fungal threads. And again, you have to picture the surface of these tubes all being this absorptive surface that's both absorbing things from the substrate. Typically it's happening more at the branch, at the tips of all the branches, but they're secreting these enzymes. You know, they don't have mouths or anything. The way that they get their nutrition is they absorb it from the environment. But to absorb large molecules is really difficult. So what they do is they spit out these digestive enzymes onto their substrate, digest it outside of their bodies, and then absorb the broken down bits. So in Quebec, Canada is a fantastic place to encounter these things. It's evolved to a point where now very complex, large fungi, mushroom-producing fungi, make this association with almost all of our coniferous trees. Tree species in Canada. So because our boreal forests are dominated by this tree type, we find this is a fantastic place for things like boletes, chanterelles. All of those come from this association. They're not mushrooms produced from breaking down plant material. They're mushrooms that are, all of their organic mass is coming from photosynthesis from their fungal partner. So that's kind of how the evolution of that and those kind of associations emerge. That's the picture that we have currently anyway, and you know, from science, and again still reflecting in the ecosystem dynamics now.
And if a forest fire burns hot enough and burns the fungi in the soil, then it's very hard for the trees to come back.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we know now is that, again, Canada being a fantastic place to observe this, a lot of our forests, our boreal forests, have this fire cycle. So every so often, the forest just burns down. You know, this happens every year. You know, we try to combat these forest fires, but they have to happen. If they don't happen, if we prevent them from happening for too long, then what happens is the leaf litter and the branches and just the dead plant material builds up too thick. So when a fire eventually does happen, which is inevitable, there's no way to completely prevent this, it'll burn hotter than it naturally would. And that extra heat or the increased intensity will burn the forest floor deeper than it normally would, to deep enough that will destroy the seeds that are stored there and the fungal spores that are and the mycelium that's stored there that would normally participate in quickly regenerating the next cycle of succession, the next successional pattern.
What are some of the most interesting aspects of that relationship between mycorrhizal fungi and plants?
With the mycorrhizal fungi, there's two broad types. There's one that kind of it's hard to see if you pull up a plant. You know, you pull up some clover in your yard, you're not going to see it. It's too thin. The filaments are too thin, and the spores that are produced are typically inside the roots themselves. So to actually visualize them, you got to stain them in the lab and things like that. But they're there, and this is the most ancient form of those, and this provides, again, the way that it impacts plant health isn't just this, you know, giving them the nutrition they need. This makes them more resistant to heat stress, to cold stress, to pollution. It allows the root system to develop more extensively. All of these these characteristics we're starting to pay attention to and apply to things like revegetation. Our mining activities generates huge amounts of nutrient-poor soil that washes away on the first rain. You know, or, you know, with every rain, you know, you lose all this sediment and get the siltation and things like that. So there's a drive to try to revegetate, bring plants back into these ecosystems. And it's not often very successful. So this awareness that these plants don't do very well without these fungi has led to trying to develop techniques to incorporate the plant along with their fungal partner to increase the success rate of these revegetation issues. This is going to have impact. It's already having impact on the way that we run nurseries, you know, the way that we transplant plants from one area to another. We know that plants survive transportation stress and repotting, things like that, a lot better when they have these associations than in the absence of these associations. So that's what we call an endomycorrhizae, because the fungus is growing kind of embedded within the root tissue itself. And this isn't just, you know, one plant, one fungus. Now, this leads to this idea of fungi being back to the idea that I was mentioning, but this idea of fungi being embedded within the ecosystem. And the way that I would view this is that fungi are essentially the glue of ecosystems. They're what's connecting all of the elements of the ecosystem together. They're closing loops of nutrient cycles. So without the fungi, wood wouldn't get broken down. The only things that can break down lignin, which is a tough component of wood, is one group of fungi. You know, without these fungi, plant matter would not get broken down, and those nutrients and energy wouldn't get returned to the ecosystem to fuel, you know, successive plant growth and animal growth and so on, just, you know, feeding back into the food webs. With spruce budworm out west, it's really the fungus that the beetle carries with it that kills the tree. It's not the beetle directly. It's the fungus that this beetle carries in its mouth and then deposits in its beetle nests in these spruce trees that kills the tree. And the beetle does this because the beetle can't digest wood. You know, like I said, there are very few things on earth can digest wood. You know, we can't just go out and take a bite out of a maple tree and get any kind of nutrition from that. And that goes for all the animal kingdom. Any animal that does consume wood, like a termite, does so by virtue of having symbiotic microorganisms like fungi either living within its gut or within its nests to break down this material. So with the spruce budworm, they're inoculating essentially their nest with this fungus that then grows in the nest, breaking down the wood, develops this lush fungal biomass in the nest. So when the eggs hatch, they have all this fungal tissue to eat. That's what they're eating. They're not eating the tree. They're eating the fungus. And then before they leave that nest, the females make sure that they store a little pouch of this fungus with them, because that's what they're going to use to inoculate their tree when they go lay their eggs in a new tree. So without that fungus, there would be no spruce budworm. And again, you know, providing another angle, you know, an avenue to attempt to control these kind of populations.
If a tree over here is lacking a particular mineral, that the mycorrhizal fungi might go and grab that mineral far away.
Right,
and bring
right,
it to
yeah,
it.
Exactly right. And this is, you know, this is what you were mentioning, you know, about this glue of the ecosystem. This isn't just a, you know, one plant, one fungus. This is the fungus can kind of leapfrog from one plant to another and physically connect the root systems, the root networks, the absorptive networks of these plants together. And some people refer to this as the wood wide web. You know, it's the Mother Nature's original internet, this network of mycelium, which is the filaments of fungus that extend throughout the soil in an ecosystem, physically linking all of the plant components there. And yeah, just like you said, you know, we know now that, you know, one fungus that's connecting several trees together can reallocate these resources to different plants. And so if one fungus prefers one species of tree, it can allocate resources to a young sapling that may be trying to get ahead to occupy and recently opened up a hole in the canopy. So in that way, the fungus is having a direct role in the plant populations in forest ecosystems.
Because I don't know if you saw Avatar, but...
I haven't actually yet. I've been...
Because this is hinted at in Avatar.
Oh, yeah?
An underground network in the root system of trees where they're all communicating with each other.
Right, yeah. And this is, I mean, this, that's just total like plagiarism from nature. You know, what people that have some... You know, knowledge of fungi would definitely identify that right away as taken from mycorrhizae for sure. And then this is, you know, it's more than just nutrients that's flowing there. It's also like chemical cues. You know, they can give a heads up to plants. We think, you know, if there's an infection in one plant, they may be able to strengthen essentially it's not truly an immune system, but the defenses of those plants. So again, these fungi having more of an impact than just nutrient allocation. They're also making them resistant to disease, and we know now to man-made pollution.
There's so few mycologists out there. Right. How much do we not know, do you think?
Oh, well, I mean, this comes full circle back to this, you know, what gets a lot of people into fungi at the beginning. I know it was the case for myself and, you know, grade 9 or 10, you know, when I was 15 or so, starting to get interested in this stuff. It was that otherness. You think that you just found something so profound that no one else cares about, that you just can't believe it. Yeah, and I still can't believe it. You know, it's 15 years later and I still absolutely cannot believe the neglect of this group, you know. And even at most university, like general biology courses, you may touch on them for a lecture, but that's about it, you know. Whereas you'll cover plants and animals especially for a lot longer. In terms of, just to give you an idea about species diversity itself, it's estimated by mycologists that we've discovered maybe 10%, 7 to 10% of all fungi that exist on Earth. We think that we've named, that's about 100,000. So 100,000 we've named and classified. That leaves, you know, we think that there's about 1 million out there. Some people put it, you know, much higher than that, you know, but it's typically given estimates between 1 million and 1.5 million. And this comes from just estimates of how many new species do we find when we go into a previously unexplored habitat, and just unexplored in terms of the fungal biomass. So you can go down, Bryce Kendrick is a Canadian mycologist. He wrote a book called The Fifth Kingdom that's used for a lot of intro mycology classes where they exist. And he talked about him and a researcher going down to Cuba, and they were just looking at the leaf litter, just what was digesting the leaves in this Cuban rainforest. And they discovered 40 new species of fungi, you know, in just this one study, in just this one location. This is totally neglected. Anytime that we go down and take species diversity surveys in, you know, rainforests, any kind of ecosystem, in order to use to justify either preserving these ecosystems or not, fungi are never included with this, which is really astounding when you think this is where we get our antibiotics. You know, penicillin revolutionized medicine, changed our relationship with infectious disease. Cyclosporin revolutionized organ transplantation, the greatest immunosuppressant drug that's out there, that's safest for the human body, is from a mold isolated from the soil and forest. You know, all these things are out there waiting to be discovered, but won't be if we destroy the habitats that they evolved in and exist in. The reason why I guess I get so interested in fungi originally, because no one talked about them. In biology class in high school, no one talked about them. In university, no one talked about them. You know, these things are totally near totally neglected, except for certain kind of subcultures which are very passionate about this stuff. But when you actually realize their place in the scheme of life, you quickly learn and realize that we would be dead without these things. If fungi disappeared today, it would be no time before all the animals and most of the plants would disappear. And one of the things that draws a lot of people, including myself, to this fascination with the fungi is their otherness. You know, when we look at plants, we walk outside, we see the plants everywhere. Plants are very different from animals, very different from us. So, you know, we have a bit of a strange relationship with plants, but they're there. They're present. They present themselves to us. We work with them. We hold them in our hands almost daily. We wear them, things like that. But the fungi, they don't present themselves to us and and have had a totally different kind of impact on the history of humanity and our association with them. They seemingly pop out of nowhere overnight. You know, the mushroom is the only real physical manifestation of the fungi that we encounter. And these can appear literally overnight. You know, some of these mushrooms can grow from nothing to, you know, 15 centimeters tall in a matter of 2 hours. This totally confounded people for a long time, to the point where, you know, the mythologies, their previous understanding through history was, you know, these things, fungi are superfluous moisture. They're not even an organism. You know, we can't find any seeds, we can't find any eggs or anything like that, because we just didn't have the technology to observe their spores. We didn't have magnification or microscopes to be aware that they produce these microscopic spores for their dispersal reproduction. No one really knew what these things were, where they came from, and this is partly because their actual bodies, you know, the body of the fungus, the mushroom just being what we call the fruit body, the reproductive organ, is what's visible, but the actual body of the fungus, which can be hundreds of kilometers wide. You know, the largest organism on Earth is a fungus growing in Washington State, about the size of 1,000 football fields, has been going strong for about 1,500 years. But all of that body is buried in the ecosystem. It's kind of acting like a glue within the ecosystem, and only presents itself again as sporadic clusters of mushrooms here and there. Because they don't present themselves to us, we have kind of a weird relationship with them, especially in the West and kind of Anglo-Saxon heritage. We have what has been called by a man, Gordon Wasson, in the middle part of the 20th century, is a mycophobic culture. You know, when you ask a lot of people on the street around here, what do you think about my, or I'm really into fungi, what do you think about that? And they kind of look at you strange, ugh, and you're into molds, and it's the stuff that grows between your toes, and when my shoes are rotten from whatever, walking in the lake. But other cultures have developed, you know, a different attitude to them, what this man Gordon Wasson and his wife Valentina termed mycophilic culture, or mycophiles. And I would consider myself a mycophile. And these are people that absolutely love fungi, especially mushrooms. You know, people that go out foraging for mushrooms, collect wild mushrooms, like cooking with them, and so on. And these are primarily like Asian cultures, Eastern European cultures, like Slovakian cultures. If you go over there, you'll find a very different history. And the central book outlining these kind of histories and relationships was by this couple, Gordon and Valentina Wasson, in the 50s, called Mushrooms, Russia, and History, outlining the mythology of fungi and their impact on our storytelling and even religious practices. And this book is criminally unavailable. They published about 500 copies of it in total. And they're really into this kind of glorious binding. And so they made these just beautiful, beautiful volumes that cost them an arm and a leg to publish. And so they only made 500 so it was a bit of an elitist move on their part. But it's never been republished. And so there's only these 500 and some odd copies in existence. You look online, they're, you know, $3,000 if one ever becomes available secondhand. But McGill University has a copy in the rare books division. And very, very interesting read. And just the language that this man's wife, who is Russian, talks, the way she talks about fungi is very, very different than the way you read about it in more Western European histories, talking about fungi as a foul fungus and this, you know, the evil toadstools and things like that. In Russia, you find, you know, songs and praises. But I think, you know, we're going to have to get to a point, especially with the emergence of conservation movements and environmentalism, we're going to have to come to terms with our relationship, not just with mushrooms as food and fun, but as fungi in general, including the yeasts and molds and all of that, reevaluate our relationship with that and understand what they can teach us about taking care of the environment and how to manage our human systems a lot better. So I think that the tide is starting to change, and there will be, you know, in our lifetime a growing interest. And I'm hoping that, you know, in the next few decades, there'll be kind of a shoving aside of our mycophobic ways, and we start embracing a more mycophilic attitude towards fungi.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for speaking to us
today.
My
absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ron.
Okay, take care.
You too.
I am the host and producer of Equilibrium, a radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and I am fascinated by ecology and the human-animal relationship, and I want to inform you, the listener. If you're an environmental activist, scientist, or just somebody that is concerned about the future health of the planet's ecology, this is a podcast for you. The Equilibrium Podcast with your host, Ryan Young.
And that was an interview from years ago with Sharif Darwish, who is a biologist who teaches biology at John Abbott College and is a self-proclaimed mycophile, which is a passionate lover of fungi or mushrooms. And you are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're basically out of time, so we'd like to play a song. But before we play a song, we'll let you know that you can email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca. You can send us comments or suggestions there. We also have an affiliated podcast on Spotify, which is called the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. My name is Ryan Young. Thanks for listening to the show today. And we're going to leave you with this funny little song about foraging for fungi or fungi. And this is Colleen Kitchen with her song, Fungi.
No matter how hard I train my brain, I could easily make a mistake. This one's purple, this one's brown, this one is umbilicate, and this one's upside down. Fungi, out foraging for fungi. Maybe I'll find a shaggy mane, King Bolita Morel, wolf farts, hedgehogs, conks, or psilocybes, or maybe even chanterelles. Waiting for the sky to dry, finding fungi to identify. Some are impossible for sure to guess, some are the kiss of death, some will make you endure gastrointestinal distress. Fungi, out foraging for fungi. Maybe I'll find a shaggy mane, King Bolita Morel, wolf farts, hedgehogs, conks, or psilocybes, or maybe even chanterelles. Go in to the forest or field, whether cloudy or sun, key in fungi is always a risk. Finding one to take home and eat is lots of fun. Always the danger that you're wrong. Fungi, out foraging for fungi. or maybe even chanterelles, or maybe even chanterelles, or maybe even chanterelles.
My name is Donald Hall, welcoming you, the distinguished listeners, to another edition of the Full Circle Show. I hope you and your family will be blessed this morning. Special greetings goes out to Kai Kindu and family.
Where's all your glory? What's that?